thing. And, well, I'll describe where this is coming from when I come to it. We then, the next 2 weeks, as I mentioned, have guest lecturers. So next Wednesday, which is, I believe, the 29th, next Wednesday, the 29th, we have Daniele Origi on skin foam models. And he is one of the major people in the field. He's visiting now. When he was a graduate student, he wrote one of the, I think he wrote the first review paper in the subject. So he should be very good. He wanted me to ask you, so how many people here know about, among the students, know about Feynman diagrams for ordinary quantum theories? Okay, and you guys not so much. So he will then start in review. Spin foam models are related to Feynman diagrams, but he'll start and review the Feynman diagrams. You won't assume that they're known. Okay. Then the following week, which is April 3rd, 4th, 5th, is Bikar Hussain. And he is going to be talking about models of black holes. And particularly with regard to the issue of singularities. So there are recent results in loop quantum gravity and some actually a broader class of theories which show that in some models, not yet the full theory, but in some models, cosmological singularities are removed and replaced by bounces, and black hole singularities are removed. So that's what he's going to be talking about. Then we resume, and if I remember right, and here is Danielle, okay? If I remember right, one of the talks in April, somebody remind me which date is the day of the presentation. 19th, that's what I remember. Okay. So then we will have April 12th, you'll have me again, and 19th is presentations. And that will be the end of the formal part of the course, but if there's interest, we'll keep going. But we'll talk about that when we get there. Okay. I mean, in the past, in these lectures, if there was interest, we kept going a few more lectures just to finish covering the subject. Okay, questions? Okay, last time I gave a... You're telling jokes about me, I can tell.
No, 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 no. It
took too much fuss. You're probably just realizing that? You're only just realizing that? That I think too much about myself. After having known me for how long? I was flattered. Okay. In the discussion of these operators, I'm actually following pretty closely the material in Chapter 6 of Carlo Rovelli's book. He discusses these different operators. Good. So last time I gave a general discussion of issues of operators and renormalization, regularization, and so forth, and operator products. Today I'm just going to give some examples, and I'm going to be detailed per area and then sketchy to just give you the main features of how the operators are constructed for the volume and the Hamiltonian constraint. operator. But I want to start by telling you what's the key idea. So the key idea starts with critiquing the operator for the trace of the frame field at a point, E of X, and which is classically the inverse metric multiplied by the determinant of the metric downstairs. So how would we construct an operator for that at a point? And there's the following puzzle, which comes about when we remember that we're background independent. If we're background independent, there's no background metric. And what it means that there's no background metric is that there's no classical densities. There's nothing that implies there's sort of no classical or background density to play the role of sort of square root of the determinant of the metric. Okay. And that has the following consequence. It's, however, true that local operators in quantum field theory are densities. Local momentum. Although it's more general, but I'll concentrate on momentum. And the reason is implicit every time you have a Poisson bracket like this, this is a density and a distribution. On this side, this is a scalar. So what is this? And to match the fact that this is a density, that the delta function does transform like a density, then the momentum is a density. Another way, there are many ways to see that. Quantum mechanically, a momentum works like d by d of a field. And thereby, something whose action on something which is a field, which is not a density, produces a density that is, it's just a different way of writing the same thing, d phi of y, d phi of x is a delta function of x and y, which is a density. So local operators representing momenta are densities. Typically, that means that there's always something pi of f, which is the integral of f against pi, which is usually in quantum field theory the operator. Because there are always issues with local operators, you smear against where what I mean by f here is some smooth test function. Okay. So if I put together these facts, then the question is, what becomes of operator products? So if I have an operator, so I call this the operator pi hat, and I should fill in, you know, there's a minus I h bar there. What am I going to do about products of operators? So how am I going to define pi operator of x squared? What's that going to be? And the problem is, if that's going to be a local operator, so supposing that there is something, I don't know, I'll call it question mark squared of x, then what is the density weight of question mark? And the thing is that, so let me just call it question, not question mark squared, let me just call that the question mark operator. Okay. If the question mark operator, see, the question is, here's the problem. Okay. If this operator is a local operator in a quantum field theory, then it's a distribution. Because generically, operators in quantum field theories are distributions. But if it's a distribution, then that implies it's a density. And not just a density, it's a density of weight 1. Why? Because a distribution is something that can be integrated against a function to give a number. It's in the dual space of the space of functions. So it's something that you can integrate against a function to give a number. And that means it is something that could live inside of an integral and give just, well, give a single operator, but in particular something that's well defined. However, if this is a density of weight 1, then there is a mismatch of density weights, because this is a product of two things of density is of weight 1. So there's a contradiction, because this defining relationship implies you have two choices. Okay. Either this is a density of weight 2, because the left-hand side is a density of weight 2. Or another possibility is there is a missing density. So you could imagine that pi of x times pi of x is some missing density, I'll call it rho of x times question mark of x, where this is not an operator, it's some density, I'll call it rho. Okay, that's a possibility. Then this is two density weights. This is a local operator, which is a density of weight 1. And there's some density which appears. So that's a possibility. Yes?
I'm confused. Why don't we have the same problem in the classical field?
Because there's not the requirement that a local operator is a distribution. It's not the understanding that in classical field theory, classical fields are just classical fields. They can have any weight. They can have any transformation properties. In quantum field theory, a local operator is something which only does something at a point. And therefore, and I don't know that I can prove this in front of you from axioms, but there are treatments where they do. Therefore, it's something which is distribution valued. And that's what's different between the quantum theory and the classical theory. So there's always the possibility that the product of the two operators produces some classical density here. The problem is, and this is where background-dependent ordinary quantum field theory differs from background-independent quantum field theory. In background-dependent quantum field theory in Minkowski space, this is what happens after renormalization. So there's, in other words, there's a procedure to multiply operators that point together in ordinary quantum field theory, which is renormalization or normal ordering. And if you trace what happens carefully, then you discover that there is snuck in some square root of the determinant of the metric. But that's in background-dependent quantum field theory where there is a metric. If there is no classical metric, that's why I emphasize this, then if such a thing appears, then you fail. And what does it mean that you fail? The implication is if the procedure to multiply the two operators together produces something which is classical, which is like a density, okay, then the theory has in it some classical non-dynamical object, which is a density. For example, whatever procedure you have, and maybe I didn't make this clear, the point about quantum field theory is that operators may be defined naively at points, but products of operators at points are not defined naively. You have to have a procedure to define what you mean by the product of two operators at a point. So if your procedure produces something which is a classical density, okay, which is not there in the dynamics of the theory, then you've broken diffeomorphism invariance. That is, you've produced something which sits there and takes up transformation properties under diffeomorphisms that's not there in the original dynamics of the theory and is produced by the rules to multiply operators together. So the conclusion is that then diffeo invariance is broken. Now, there are many ways to do that because already in ordinary quantum field theory in the presence of a metric, we know renormalization procedures to multiply operators together and get other local operators. So you can just say, okay, you want to multiply these operators together, let's just pretend that we're in, you know, some standard quantum field theory, let's introduce a background metric and let's use the rules of that standard quantum field theory and do renormalization and multiply the operators together, and then you'll get here the determinant of the metric of that background field. And if you go through that in detail, in fact, that's what you'll get. I mean, I'm not going to take you through the detail, but you will. Otherwise, you have a contradiction here. And the contradiction is a problem. And the challenge is, could there be some rule, if we want to construct, say, I want to construct a volume operator or an area operator, which involve products of E's, which are momentum operators, okay, or I want to construct an operator that measures the metric at a point, the challenge is, how do you multiply operators together at a point and get an answer, which is a finite, well-defined operator, without breaking diffeomorphism invariance. Okay, that's the challenge. Okay, is that clear? Because there's an answer to the challenge, so I want to make sure that the challenge is clear.
So where is exactly the point in normal ordering where we need the background?
In normal ordering, the decomposition of an operator into positive frequency and negative frequency parts uses the background metric. And in every other renormalization procedure or subtraction procedure that you use in ordinary quantum field theory, if you look at it carefully, or the way to tell is study it in a curved spacetime in which it matters what the metric is, and it's a function of position. And then you always discover that missing transformation properties are taken up by the background metric. Okay. So here's what I think the answer is. And this is, by the way, the path that we went through when trying to figure out if this was a physical theory or not. This was exactly the challenge. And I can assure you we made every mistake possible along the route here. So if the challenge is clear, let me tell you what I think the answer is. The first answer is just simply that quantum mechanically there is, that just does not exist. Okay. Generically, although in some special cases, I can tell you what this operator is. And as a kind of warm up, I might do it. But generically, this operator doesn't exist. And there is, so far as I know, no operator which is a well defined operator which does not depend on background structure, which represents the metric at a point. But what does, there, then there's an interesting observation. And the interesting observation is that, well, let me speak about the area. So for the area, we pick some surface, S. Okay, let me remember the context is that there's our background three-dimensional geometry sigma or manifold sigma, which is has no metric on it. The surface is living in it, or it might be that the surface is the boundary of sigma, or S is contained in sigma. Those are those two cases. And I'll talk about this one where it's contained first, and then the second one, where it's the boundary. Just for some notation, the surface is given by, the surface has coordinates on it, sigma 1 and sigma 2. And so we have sigma alpha, the sigma 1, the sigma 2 coordinates on the surface. And the position of the surface is SA of sigma alpha. That's the position. So given the two sigma, that labels the point in space where the surface is. Okay? And I'm a little bit concerned with something, but no, that's fine. That's fine. And the area of the surface turns out to be constructed in the following way. If I have a point, maybe I should have drawn it up here. So if I have a point here on the surface, I have two vectors, del S A del sigma 1, del S A del sigma 2. And so I can make a one-form NA at a point on the surface. So it's NA, which is the function of the points on the surface, which is epsilon ABC del SB del sigma 1 del SC del sigma 2. And that's a one-form which points out of the surface. It's not orthogonal to the surface because there's no metric. So there's no metric, so you can't raise the index and say, I have a vector which is orthogonal to the surface, but one can have a one form which is pointing out of the surface. And then you can construct the following object, which is NA, BAI, NB, EBI, where I'm tracing the internal indices. Take its square root. And if you work through what this object is, this object is a density on the surface. So you can integrate that against the surface. Why is it like a density on the surface? Because it's a density, it's two powers of a density in space, but you lose one degree, you lose the density in the direction orthogonal from this construction, and then you have two powers of a density on the surface, and you take the square root, and you get a density on the surface, and that is defined to be the area of the surface. There are other ways to define it, but this is an expression for the density of the surface. Maybe I could just tell you a more standard way to define it, and then I can leave it as an exercise for you to check, would be to, given the metric of free space QAV, you can subtract off NA and B, and that is HAV, which is the metric in the tangent space on the surface. And then A of the surface is also the integral d2 sigma on the surface, square root of the determinant of H. And then it's just a simple problem of manipulation to show that this is equal to this, which I'll leave for you to check. This is the natural thing you would think the area is geometrically. It's the determinant, it's the square root of the determinant of the metric intrinsic in the surface integrated over the surface, it happens that it's represented by this beautiful formula here. Okay. Now, why is this relevant for what I said? Because notice that here we have, supposing I can now try to make an operator out of this, supposing I try to make an operator A hat of S. Okay. And so the instructions are, we know what the operator for E is. N is a classical object which just knows about the surface and its coordination. So this is a product of E's, much like that's a product of E's up there. But what we need to do is multiply them together at a point and take the square root. And when I take the square root, I convert the thing from being a density of weight 2 to a density of weight 1, and then I integrate it. And the insight is that because the square root of the product of the operators is then again a density of weight 1, there can be a local operator associated with it, which can then be integrated to give this operator. So the instructions are to invent some limits, which I'm going to tell you about, limits in which something, which I have to tell you about, goes to 0, okay, in which in quotes you integrate over something which is in quotes the square root of the square of E. Okay, and I have to tell you a rule for multiplying these operators together, taking the square root and integrating, that gives you a finite, well-defined operator on the space of states that we've been working with, that we defined in previous lectures, okay, and B gives you actually an object which is diffeomorphism invariant and well-defined. So that's the challenge. And the key idea is, well, we can't multiply operators together because the density weights are wrong, but maybe we can multiply them together and then take the square root. And if that seems completely nuts.
But so then you should have get like infinitely many normal ordering constants if you want to have three ways in the square root.
Indeed, there's lots of wrong with, there's lots of, in any.
Because you need to consider every order of the expansion of the square root.
There's two ways to take the square root. Okay? There's two ways to define the square root in the quantum mechanics. Okay? One way is to do some complicated perturbative calculation where you have to do an expansion of something around something else. And you're right, we would be in bad shape if we had to do that. The other way is to diagonalize the operator that you want to take the square root of exactly. And if you know the exact spectrum of an operator, its square root is the same basis with the eigenvalues which are the square root. Okay? So that's what we're going to do. Yeah, so a good, by the way, a good thing to do is to stop thinking about quantum field theory in terms of expanding around classical things or free things and start trying to think about quantum field theory as solving problems that you can solve, exactly. Okay? So let's see how we do this. So how I'm going to do this is I'm going to first describe a purely classical object which is complicated and which has the property that in some limits it yields back again the classical expression. But that, every step in that construction is going to be realizable quantum mechanically. So we start like this. We start by dividing the surface into a large number of pieces, which we call S I. Let me use capital I. So we have lots of little pieces. And we're going to try to define an expression for the square of the area of a little piece of the surface. Okay? And supposing that we can do that, supposing I could define an operator for the square of the area of a little piece. Then the operator, supposing I could do that, I had some, but that went down to some operator called a squared half I. Then we could take its square root, and supposing I could do what I just said, I could exactly diagonalize that operator. Then I can take its square root quantum mechanically, and I could sum it up for the eyes. And that would be an expression for the area of the surface. Okay. Now, I can't do that. But what I can do is construct a guy here, which is not the area of the surface, but converges to the area of the little, converges to the square of the area of the little piece of the surface in the limit that you look at a very, very small piece of surface. So then you would want to add to this the limit in, I didn't tell you, so there, you divide this up into n pieces. So then you would want to study a limit in which the number of pieces goes to infinity. So there are n pieces, you add them up, and then you go to infinity. That's going to be the strategy. Okay? So now the question is, what can I define on the surface? So now I have a little piece of my surface. Here's my little piece. I call it SI. Okay. And what can I define easily? Okay. Well, what I can define easily, all I have is I have E's. I have N's into E's, which are then densities on the two surface. Then N into E. See, E is a vector density in 3 space contracted with the one form N. This is a density in the 2 surface. And that's, I want you to check that, but it's not very hard. The epsilon here cancels the density weight in 3 space. So N starts off as an inverse density in 3 space. That cancels this. And then the d sigma 1, d sigma 2 makes it transform like a density in the surface. And remember, this is anti-symmetrons. So this transforms just like a determinant of a vector in the surface. And the determinant of a derivative of a vector in the surface is transforms like a density. So in other words, n transforms like a density in the surface times an inverse density in the manifold, I multiply that by something which is a density in the manifold, and I get something which is a density in the surface. So a thing that I'm free to do is integrate just in this little region Si of Na e twiddle A. So I claim that integral makes sense because this is a density in the 2 surface and I just integrated a little piece of the 2 surface. I can do it once, and let's call this d2 sigma. So this guy is a function of sigma. If I can do it once, I can do it again, integral d2 sigma prime. And now I put here e the same object, but just at the point sigma prime. And I have the gauge index, I'll call just J for a moment. So now I have something where I've integrated the E twice on the little piece of the surface. I haven't integrated them at the same point. I'm not squaring and integrating. I'm integrating twice. But it's well defined. Yes?
But you have some terms with sigma equals sigma prime, you get some nasty stuff.
You get some nasty stuff, but it's balanced under integrals. So the question is.
So then they have zero natural.
You have to look at all the states in your Hilbert space and make sure that you can make sense of this acting on all the states in your Hilbert space, which we'll do. Actually, I won't do rigorously. That's what Thomas Tiemann's book is for, and the review of Novashikar and Lempkowski and so forth. I won't do it rigorously, but I'll show you why it works. Okay. So this is well defined. Now, it's not gauge invariant under the SU2 gauge transformation. Because here I have an E at some point sigma, and a typical point in these two integrals has the operator, the field at sigma, and the other one at sigma prime. And this has an index I under gauge transformation. This has an index J under internal SU2 gauge transformation. That's rotations of the frame field for visitors sitting in. And so this is not invariant under independently rotating the gauge field, the frame fields here and here. Okay. So you have a problem with gauge invariance. Now, there are two attitudes towards that. You can actually just leave it there, and it doesn't actually do any harm, because in the limit, when you shrink the surface down, those points have to sit more and more near to each other, and gauge invariance is, quote, restored. But if you're a chicken like I am, you'd rather restore gauge invariance in the thing all the way through. By the way, what I didn't say it, but what I'm doing is I'm inventing a regularization procedure. That is, I'm inventing a way to define an operator in a quantum field theory through a limit in which we introduce some extra structure which gives us a finite operator such that the limit of the corresponding classical object is the classical thing we want to define, and such that the limit of the quantum object is a finite well-defined operator. So such a procedure is called a regularization procedure, and that's what we're doing here. We're inventing a regularization procedure. So what we can do is embed this in the kind of object we were talking about in the last two lectures. So let me just give myself some space here. And let me take the I's off. So let me remind you, if I write E just A, that means the guy with the index in the SU2 times some Pauli matrix tau I. So now I've written the thing as an SU2 matrix, and I have another one over here, just giving myself some more room. That's an SU2 matrix. And what do I want to do? I want to close them up with some other stuff that transforms under SU2. So it's gauge invariant. And how do I do that? Well, why don't I draw a curve between these two points? So now I invent something, which is that for every two points in the region, on the surface actually, I have a little curve that I'll call eta sigma sigma prime. Now, again, there's no classical metric on this space. So I can't say take the geodesic or take the shortest distance between two points. I just have some procedure which gives me a smooth curve between any two points on the surface But I have some requirements on that. So let me just list them. So eta sigma sigma prime gives me a curve for all pairs of points in the surface. And my properties are it's in the surface, so it's a curve that runs in the surface. And another property is that the limit as I take sigma to sigma prime of a to sigma sigma prime is the point sigma. I guess what I really mean, well, I think that makes it clear. So that you don't want, you want as you bring these two guys together, you want the curve to shrink down to a point. Okay. Now, for some rigorous applications, you need a slightly more. You need that there's some metric. So a stronger, this is a sort of stronger property, which is that in some arbitrary, so pick some metric, pick some arbitrary, smooth, actually, let's just make it flat. What the hell? Pick some arbitrary flat metric on the three-dimensional space. So this is a metric whose only role is to give you better control rigorously over this limit, then the distance s along the curve sigma sigma prime goes to zero as sigma prime goes to sigma. Okay, so that's just a little bit stronger. Okay, not only does the curve go to a point, but it goes to a point in such a way that if whatever flat metric you choose in the space, the length of that curve is going to zero. So it's not doing some funny thing where it's oscillating a lot or something like that. Okay? So then I can introduce a parallel transport U of A to sigma sigma prime. So I go, I start here at sigma, I parallel transport to sigma sigma prime, then I act with my second field E, and then I go back A to inverse sigma sigma prime. And then I trace the whole thing. Okay, so that's now gauge invariant. That's now independent of frame rotations in space. Okay. And that object is defined as this thing, as a squared of I. Okay. Any question about that? Now, what I'm then going to do is I'm going to study a squared of I acting on the states of the theory. I'm going to show that it can be diagonalized. There's going to be a certain moment, if you want all the nitty-gritty details, when Mohammed was nice enough to come, is going to help diagonalize it. And then having diagonalized it, we're going to take the square root. We're going to sum over all the regions. And then we're going to take the limit in which the number of regions goes to infinity. Okay. And I have tried this before at home. So this is not the first time this is tried. Okay. Or I wouldn't be showing you such a crazy thing. Okay. What do I need? I think I don't need this, so I'll come and work here. Okay? Let me remind you of the key expression, which is that E A I of X acting on a loop, or, and, well, let me just start with, so here I have some loop, and here I have E at some point x acting on T of gamma. And the instructions are you multiply by an object that I believe I defined last time was delta A x. So let me actually let me rediscover it and then remind you what it was. You get an integral ds along the curve. You get a gamma dot A. So if you act, the index A turns into a gamma dot, a tangent vector on the curve of S. This makes something reparametrization variant. You get delta 3 of X gamma of S. And then if you pick up that singular term, then you get the trace of U gamma. Let's say the curve closes. Starting from that point, so let me call that the point here S star, the point where you break. Where the E is, so gamma of S star is equal to X, where the E is, okay, times tau I. Okay. Remember that we've discussed that formula several times. And this object here has been called delta A of X and gamma. Okay. Now, let's compute. I'm just looking for a lot of room here. Let's compute our A squared object. And let's do it first on one loop, and then let's do it on more complicated spin networks. So now I have a surface, a little piece of the surface, Si. I have a loop, which might or might not go through that surface. I'll call it gamma. And let me construct the operator A squared. It's not the square of an operator, A squared is just its name. I acting on T of gamma. Okay, so we start. We integrate D to sigma prime. We integrate D to sigma. I'm going to, there are several ways to do it, but I'm going to just extract the whole trace up here. So I'm going to do trace tau I U eta sigma prime tau j U eta inverse sigma prime, and all this stuff sits to the left. And then I have first, now you worry about ordering issues.
Yes.
Okay. You might worry that this E, should it act on this U here? Okay. So I just keep that in mind. I'll come back. What I'm first going to do is act with both of these guys going to the right and acting on the states. But then I'll come back and worry about the E acting on these guys here.
Well, what I worried about was with sigma equals sigma prime, whether you get some.
We're going to worry about that too. Okay? Okay? But, so, sorry, maybe I'm aligning you to say that you're worried about the E acting here, but somebody should worry about that. So if somebody wants to take responsibility to worry about that, at any rate, we will come back to that. Okay, so now I have the first E, which is into N. So I have here an expression, and look at what I have. I have the integral d2 sigma na of sigma into this object delta a of s of sigma gamma. So I've just taken the integral d sigma, and I guess I'm doing it in the other order. So I'm taking the integral d sigma prime, na of sigma prime, delta a. Then I do the same thing with the other one. So I have an integral, this looks remarkably like the thing we just did, nb of sigma, delta b of s of sigma gamma. Okay? And then I have the trace of the tau of the u with the taus going through it. And what does that say? And now we have to think about cases. Okay? So first, the instructions are, when I come with the first one, to break the u there and insert a tau right there. So I have to take the trace of u, we call this point S star. So I have a tau. The first one I acted is here. Let's call that guy I. Well, we did. We called it I. So I have a trace of tau I u, and this is gamma broken at the point S star. Then we come with the second one. Watch closely. We come with the second one, and we have to do the same thing. Okay. That is, strictly speaking, we apply the d by dA to this when we come the second time. And there are going to be two terms. Basically, when we come the second time, we have the limit where we act from this side coming from here, and the limit when we act from the other side coming from there. Because we're taking the derivative by the a at that point, and it appears, roughly speaking, twice, once from the front and once from the back. And so we actually get two terms. In one of them, the tau I and then tau j in that order, and the other one, tau j, tau I in that order. And we get both of them. In other words, there's only one point on the loop where the operators act, both operators act at the same point, but they act in an order, and we have to symmetrize. Now we know, in fact, yes.
So the augmented words only affect on the upper bound.
You're right. My apologies. You're right. Thank you. Thanks. Okay. Boy, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
So this then sits down here. Okay. This, all of this is a C number function which we pulled outside. This was sitting on the left side of the operator, and this is what remains of the state as a functional of A. So they go in that order, the C number stuff, the operator valued stuff, or the that was still inside the operator, and the state. Okay? And I apologize for getting things out of order. Okay, now, there are several ways you could justify the symmetrization here. One of them is that the E's quantum mechanically do commute with each other. And this was from the action of two E's, so you better get something that's symmetric. Okay, I also gave a kind of hand-waving argument about how you bite from one side or bite from the other side. Okay, so I have to compute this. That's an integral over a singular function. So since I defined it here, let me just compute it. So I have some surface. I have a curve through the surface, gamma. The surface is Si, and parameterized by sigma on the surface. And what we're trying to compute is integral d2 sigma na sigma and delta A, which is an integral ds, and I'm going to bring that integral outside, gamma dot A of s, delta 3 of s of sigma, gamma of s. Yes?
But the parameter of sigma is also in the first expression of bracket.
Yes, that's why this, yeah, so strictly speaking, you're right, and I'm wrong. I'm sorry, the parameter of sigma, that's right. So this comes here inside these integrals. I know, but I'm still telling you how to do this integral. I agree with you, and we'll come back and look at that. Okay? But I want to just discuss how to do this. Okay? And then I will come back. Thanks for pointing that out. So this is an object that we looked at before. And let me just remind you, somewhere I had the NA. So the NA is there. And I think there's no way to see it twice, but it's the integral ds, integral d2 sigma. The na is epsilon abc del sb del sigma 1 del sc del sigma 2 and gamma dot, I'm going to write out, d gamma a ds and delta 3 S of sigma, gamma of S. Okay. So we had this before. And what this is the intersection number of the curve with the surface. It's completely diffeomorphism invariant and coordinate invariant. That is, it's invariant under diffeomorphisms of the surface, or it's also invariant under reparametrizing the sigmas, the surface. And it's invariant under reparametrizing the S of the curve. Given that, we can make this expression very simple. We can pick the surface to be, so we can just pick the surface to be, we can pick three coordinates. S is equal to Z, and the surface is Z equals 0, and then a coordinate x equals sigma 1, and a coordinate y equals sigma 2. And when we just pick rectangular coordinates, which we're allowed to do, in which this is the z-axis out here, and the curve is just coming into the z-axis, and let's make the curve also, let's make the curve the y equals z equals 0. So I'm looking for a place to draw this. So we just choose coordinates in which this is the y-axis, this is the x-axis, this is the z-axis, and the curve comes in on the z-axis and is the z-axis. And then these are just either ones or zeros. If we go epsilon x, y, z, and these are just x, y, and z. So these are just all one. when the epsilon, when the ABC is X, Y, Z. So the whole thing is 1. And then this delta 3 just becomes delta of S is equal to S0, delta of sigma 1 is equal to 0, and delta of sigma 2 is equal to 0, because that's where the intersection is. So then we just have integrals over deltas with nothing else. So then this is equal to 1. If there was no place where the curve intersected the surface, I couldn't do that, and I would get 0. Or if the orientation were reversed, so that you got a minus sign from the epsilon, you would get minus 1. So the point is that this is nothing other than the intersection number of the surface and the curve. I.e., it's plus 1, minus 1, or 0. So it's not actually, it's the intersection of the curve and the surface just in that little region. Okay? Now, to come to your question, as I'm integrating, so let me not do that evaluation. I'm going to postpone it for a moment. As I'm integrating d sigma and d sigma prime, okay, there is actually only one point in sigma and one point in sigma prime where it's non-zero, where you pick up a non-zero term. Okay. And that's when sigma is equal to sigma prime is equal to this intersection point. So the only non-zero term is when sigma is equal to sigma prime is equal to, I'll call it sigma star, the intersection point. So that intersection point is S star and sigma star. At that point, then this, by the assumptions I made for eta, this is U of a curve which is shrunk to a point. The sigma and sigma prime are the same. So this is parallel transport along a curve of infinitesimal length, so it's 1. And therefore, this becomes just trace of tau I, tau j. So this becomes a trace of tau I, tau j. This is a normalization issue, and let me assume that it's normalized to delta ij, since I didn't actually give the normalization. So this object here just becomes delta ij. That multiplies this tau I, tau j, but tau I squared is 1 with the Pauli matrices. So you just get a factor of 1 from each of 3 terms, plus another factor of 1 from each of 3 terms. So you just get 6. So the whole thing becomes the intersection number squared of the surface and the curve times just trace of U of gamma. There's nothing else sitting here, so it's just the trace of U and gamma. So that's what we started with. So it's just T of gamma. So what we learned, and remember what this was the operator that I called the operator A squared I acting on T of gamma. And so we learned that the loop that runs once through the surface element is an eigenstate of the operator, and the eigenvalue is 1. Okay. So here's one eigenstate. Okay, now, I'm being a little bit sloppy with units and dimensions, but I'm going to come back. And in fact, why don't I come back and fix that right now?
Sorry.
Yeah.
Just at the peak, I guess it's kind of a change the gravity of the curve of the gamma in the power function. Because the two has.
Oh, you mean you're confusing this little ass with this big ass? Yeah. You're right. You're right. This is over some big surface S. Okay. Okay. If there's some color chart, we can make it a different color. I apologize for that. Okay. I'm just looking for a place to put that. Well, let me push this up, and then I'll use a blackboard here. In the connection to gravity, I left out a factor, and the factor that I left out is that the, if you remember starting with the, this is a different S, the action for gravity, we started with an integral of B wedge F, and we found that the conjugate momentum pi is related to B. I'm just trying to pick a factor, so I'm going to be sloppy about the other properties. Okay, this is the pi conjugate to the A that sits in here, because it's a term A dot that sits in there. Okay. But, and then later, we find that this is equal to E wedge, is related to E wedge E, and is the object that we call E, which is related to the metric. Okay. Now, the problem is that there's a dimensional problem. And the reason is that in gauge fields, connections A have dimensions of 1 over length, and metrics are dimensionless. So if, because a metric is dimensionless, because in a formula like ds squared is gab dxa dxb, dxa is a length in some coordinate system. Ds squared is the square of the length. So the metric is dimensionless. So if a metric is dimensionless, then the E is dimensionless. Okay. But the electric field conjugate, say, to a gauge field is not dimensionless. So there's a dimensions problem. And the solution of the dimensions problem is that if you want B to be dimensionless, and you want, this is an integral d4x, you want the action to be dimensionless. So this is a curvature is a 1 over length squared. This is an integral length to the fourth. So you need something with dimensions of 1 over length squared. And so there should be some constant here, which is turns out to be 1 over Newton's constant dimensionally. And I'm being sort of sloppy, and I'm doing everything at h bar equals 1. Units, so that an h bar equals 1 unit, the Newton's constant has dimensions of 1 over length squared. I'm sorry, the Newton's constant has dimensions of length squared. So there is then the momentum is then related to g. Let me see. Then the momentum is. Do I have this right? Which way is it? The momentum, sorry, is 1 over g times e. And what that means is that quantum mechanically, the operator for e is g times the operator for a momentum. And so it's h bar g times d by dA. So I forgot to write the h bar and the g here. If I write the H bar in the G, that comes all the way back to here. I missed here an H bar and a G. And therefore, I missed here an H bar G squared. And therefore, the eigenvalue has an H bar G squared in it. Okay. And I forgot to mention the 6. And I'm not doing this to get the numerical factors right, but I wanted to get the dimensional factors right. Okay. So I have some eigen states of this operator A squared of I. Now, let's just look at some more complicated situations. So what if the curve came through twice? So maybe I can draw that over here. What if here's the surface, and the curve comes through the surface, moves around, and comes back again? Well, if you trace through what happened, there were the two operators hitting here and here. There were the two operators hitting here and here. But then there is going to be a term where one operator hits here and one operator hits here. And then you're going to be left with the gauge field on the curve here. So if there are two, if the curve comes through twice to the element of surface, then you're going to get terms like this. That is, the U coming from here is going to join up with the U here, and interesting things are going to happen. And the important thing is that you're no longer going to get the same loops back. You're going to get some, there'll be some extra terms which involve the operator having acted here and here, and the parallel transport along the little curve between those two dots. So it's no longer an eigenstate. On the other hand, I'm going to be interested in the end in taking a limit where I take the partition of the surface smaller and smaller and smaller. So as I take the partition of the surface smaller and smaller, I will always get to a partition where the loop goes through each surface element at most once. So in this limit, I'm going to be able to, all those terms will go away. That is, in the limit, the only thing that will matter are the terms where, for each element of the partition, it goes through the curve at most once, because I just do a further partition, and this will be some S5,246, and this will be some S19,350. And they'll be in separate terms. So I'll be able to ignore that. So I can reach a conclusion, and the conclusion, and I'll so I want to first consider the simplest case, which is the following. So here is now the whole surface, and here is a state which just has one loop going through it in one place. So this is S, and this is the curve gamma. And I want to compute my full operator A of S acting on T of gamma. And remember, that's the limit as the partition goes to infinity, as I divide this into more and more and more little units of surface, of the square root of this operator A squared associated with the surface acting on T of gamma. And I claim that I can define that operator through the following steps. I wait till the partition is fine enough that there's only one partition that it goes through. I'm sorry, I said that wrong. I wait till the partition is fine enough that the curve either intersects zero times or no times. I'm sorry, zero times or one time. I'm getting, we'll take a break soon. I'm going to need it. Intersects either zero time or one time to each little surface element. So once n is greater than some nc, such that the intersection numbers are 0 or 1, or plus or minus 1, then from then on, As of T of gamma has the form of, sorry, I forgot to put the sum here, of the limit n goes to infinity, and the sum, and now I don't have to sum only under the terms where the intersection number squared is plus 1. Yeah, that is only under the terms where you have the curve going through the surface element. So let's consider each one of those terms. For each one of those terms, I ignore this, and it's like this case. In each one of those terms, the square operator, the t, is its eigenstate. And this is the eigenvalue. So I can take the square root. Now, strictly speaking, what I'm doing is very unrigorous. Because to take the square root of an operator, I can't just do it on one eigenstate. I have to diagonalize it on the whole Hilbert space, go to a basis where it's diagonal, and then take the square root. Okay? So I'm not doing it right, but later on I will explain that this is part of the basis where the operator is diagonal. But I just want you to look ahead and see what happens. So then I take the square root. The square root is, for those cases, is the square root of 6 times the square root of h bar g squared, which is h bar g, times the square root of 1 squared, or minus 1 squared, which is 1, times t of gamma. Now I can take the limit, because from now on, no matter how much I shrink the partitions, I shrink the little units of surface and partition more and more and more and more, there'll always be only as many non-zero terms in the sum as there are actual points where the curve intersects the surface. So once I'm past that n equals nc, where the curve goes through each partition either 0 or 1 times, the sum doesn't change. It has the same number of terms, and each term has the same value. So the limit is trivial. So I get simply the total number of intersections. And just the absolute value of that times square root of 6 times h bar g. Now, the square root of 6 is an artifact of a normalization that I didn't choose carefully. But the h bar g is an area. H bar g, otherwise sometimes known as the Planck length square, is 10 to the minus 66 square centimeters in round units. So it is an area, and I've gotten a little quanta of area to come out of the calculation. So this is roughly how it works. Okay. Now, let me just tell you what I haven't done. Let me see if I can find some piece of blackboard. And then we can take a break, and then after the break, go on to the other cases. Okay. What's the complete basis, eigenbasis of this operator? Okay. So consider an arbitrary graph. If you remember, an arbitrary spin network state has edges labeled by spins, J, K, L, M, N, and so forth. And then I have to worry about what happens at nodes. Okay. In the case that we've just been discussing implicitly, the case of spin 1/2 representation, that is what I started out here, I was assuming that these were 2 by 2 Pauli matrices, so this was a spin 1/2 representation. But in what I should have done, or a more general case, is going to be that first some edge of spin J goes through there. And so that requires additional calculation, because in the end, you end up here taking the trace delta ij times the trace of tau I, tau j, in some, and I'm sorry for the double letters, in some representation k, which could be any half integer. And here I need Mohammed's help, but this is related to, in representation k, k plus 1. And I don't and there's some coefficient that I don't remember that depends on the normalization. Okay. So the result is that one gets, if I come back to here, where this is spin k line, one gets here a square root of k, k plus 1 factor. So that's the that's another thing one has to worry about, but it's understood. There can also be a case in which you have a node in the surface itself. So where a node of the spin network lives in the surface. And that node can have any number of edges. In that case, there's some spin J up coming from the top, some spin J down, and at least I know the tri-bound one. And the spin, actually, is the formula I'm about to write Mohammed general? Or is it just the trivalent?
It's just trivalent.
Okay, so let's just do the trivalent. And this is the one in the middle is called JS for J surface. And in that case, the factor that you get from the combinatorics is the square root of J up plus 1, plus J down plus 1, minus JS, JS plus 1. Is that right?
There are coefficient to the J unit here.
Here?
They
take coefficients too. Okay. Okay.
And then one half.
Overall. Which really means 1 over square root of 2. Because this is 2, oh no, then it's 4, 1 half. Okay, thank you. Okay. And that's a combinatorial calculation that I'm not going to do in front of you, but it involves the Clash-Borden coefficients of multiplying the different representations together and some algebra with the Pauli matrices. And it's done, I believe it's done nicely in the book here. Okay. Finally, there are cases where there's some number of lines coming from the top, some number of lines coming from the bottom, some number of lines staying in the surface. And there's a more general formula, which I'm not remembering. Yes?
What is it? You know the surface, but you know the line is.
A node in the surface, but no, that would be a bivalent node. Oh, a node in the surface, but some lines above, some lines below.
But no node in the surface.
Yes. So the answer, so here's what happens in those cases. What happens in those cases, I'm going to tell you how to construct the answer, but I can tell you where to look it up, but I don't remember the details. But here's the salient thing. What happens in the cases of more than three lines coming in is that there are additional labels at the node. Because what lives at the node is a vector space. Let me label these J, I, IJ, K, and L. And there's a vector space there, V, IJ, K, and L. And what it is the space of invariance in the products of the representation. So the products of a vector space VI is the vector space of the representation, and you can multiply it as the vector space of the J's representation, as the vector space of the K's representation, as the vector space of the L's representation. And in that product of four vector spaces, there are invariants under SU2 transformations. And there is a finite dimensional space of such invariants under SU2 transformations. Another way to write it is it's the space of maps mu from the products of the representations to the identity. Because an invariant is a tensor in the product of those vector spaces, which is in the identity as far as the action of the group is concerned. So every invariant tensor is a map from the products of the vector spaces to an identity element as far as the action of the group is concerned. So in terms of representations, the identity element is the one-dimensional trivial representation. So this a tensor which is invariant is a map from the product of the vector spaces to the identity. And there is a finite dimensional space of such things for every I, J, K, and L. Now, what you get when you follow the same procedure is you pull out a number here times an operator, so the A squared in this case. So let me call, let me see what I'm going to have to call. So the A squared, let's call that the little surface SI. Okay. Acting on, let's call that state gamma. So this is spin network state gamma. It's connected up, we don't care how, to the rest of the universe. Is going to give us an operator acting in this vector space. So there's a little operator, alpha hat, which is an operator acting in this vector space. And it's then going to act on that vector space times something which is still the h bar g squared times some numbers, which are just some combinatorial finite numbers. And this operator has been shown to be Hermitian. It's a little matrix to be Hermitian and positive definite, actually positive. And you have to diagonalize it for every possible such intersection. And you can show that it can be diagonalized for every possible such intersection, because each possible such intersection brings with it a finite dimensional vector space. And you can construct explicitly the elements of each of these matrices. And then you therefore know how to take the square root, because you then have the complete diagonalization. So I'm not going to do these things in front of you, but they are discussed to some extent in Carlo's book and completely in all complete details in Thomas's book and a number of other places in the literature. When you're done doing this, you have in fact considered the general case, because the general case for how a surface can intersect a graph is either on edges or on nodes. And if you consider the general case of the nodes, you consider the general case. Because of the observation that you can make the partition small enough that each element contains either 0 or 1 intersection, so you can treat them separately. So you diagonalize the entire operator of a squared, and then you're able to take the square root, and then you're able to sum. And the only subtlety is that when you have intersections, you have to diagonalize separately in the little vector space associated with each intersection. Okay, questions? Yes. Look, this G came from the original classical dynamics that we quantized. It's properly called the bare means constant. There are two questions. One of them is, what's the macroscopic means constant? And to compute that, or to discuss that, you need to describe an experiment which is macroscopic, where the real means constant is measured. Until you do that, you don't know the relationship between this bare means constant and the macroscopic means constant. The second question is, should that relationship be a finite relationship or some infinite renormalization? And there is evidence that it's a finite relationship, which I think it's better. Let me discuss when we discuss more operators. But the basic pieces of evidence are, A, in calculations where we can talk about the second classical limit, as you can discuss excitations of states that look like gravitons or elementary particles, it's a finite relationship. B, in black hole entropy, it's a finite relationship where one can do exact computations. And C, in each of these operators are a finite operator, assuming that G bare is related by only a finite renormalization from G physical or G macroscopic.
But finite is not one.
Finite is not, no, finite is not one.
I think it's not.
What?
It's not that finite.
Yes, and there are several ways to see that. One way comes back, there's several ways to see that there's room for a parameter. One way is that in the U's are the path order of E to the integral of A along a curve. But you could stick a little constant there, and it would still be perfectly gauge invariant, well defined. What you get from that is a little constant here. The constant migrates to here. And that constant has a name. It's called the Inerzi parameter, named after Giorgio Inerzi. The only person I know has a parameter named after them. And there are stories to tell yet about the Inerzi parameter. From a fancy point of view, this can be said in another way. We gave up. We quantized an algebra which involves E and U. And rather than quantizing an algebra which involves E and A, so roughly speaking, we chose to quantize something which goes like E to the A rather than just E with A. And then what one sees is that there is a one-parameter family of such things. Once you exponentiate the elementary field, there's a one-parameter family. Another way to say it is that there's a one-parameter ambiguity in the representation theory of the algebra once you look just for an exponentiation, to represent the field in terms of an exponentiation. So there's a fancy language in which you analyze the representation theory, you discover a one-parameter ambiguity. And there's a non-fancy language in which you just see that it could be stuck here. Okay. Let me see if I have enough formulas on the board to make the point. No, I don't. But when we come to the black hole entropy, that parameter comes into the ratio of the black hole entropy and the area in the bare Planck units. And so one has to choose that parameter so that one, if one wants to get the 1/4 into, one has to choose the parameter. And it's known what the choice is so that it comes out right. And last time, again, Mohammed can help me, but last time I checked, before Mohammed's work, which he's about to put out, but as of what it was before Mohammed's work, it was log 3 over square root of 2, at least in some parameterization. Okay, that's about to change, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
There is a paper I mentioned to you that it says the parameter can be eliminated.
This is the conformal scaling. Yeah, I'm still trying to absorb that. Okay.
Is that the only place where you can actually exclude some?
No. There is a long story about the other way to fix it, which is due to Olaf Dreyer, and it's an older argument in the context of other theories by somebody, an Israeli guy whose name is escaping me. But you can tie it to quasi-normal modes. And you can use calculations of the quasi-normal mode spectrum to tie it down. And you get, again, Mohammed's reason for it, which is not in front of us yet. You get, is it still true that you get the same number?
No, it's not the same. Well, the outcome from the quasi-normal mode is different than the one that you take from the exact calculation.
Okay.
Both types using the human that you in one presentation they match, but in another.
So what his referring to is you could be doing a representation of SO3 or SO2, and they're slightly different. And then one may work and one may don't work.
Which is the one which SU2 doesn't work.
It's a not necessarily, but there's a long, we could devote, and if you were interested, we could devote a whole class to this discussion, because this has been a long discussion over a number of papers. So it might be worth a class. By the way, again, before Mohammed's work, it worked in supergravity perfectly. Which was a paper of Yi Ling and some collaborators. But I guess it was always the case that it worked in SO3 and didn't work in SO2. Although then there's a long discussion about whether there really are SO2 excitations, whether you can have an elementary quantum of area which is really an SO2 because maybe it's like a fermion. Let me postpone that. This is a preview of a movie, okay, which has been full of drama and romance and everything. Okay, why don't we take a break till because we've gotten longer than we usually go.